Welcome to Dig Deep, the mining podcast. In this podcast, we discuss, educate, and talk about industry news and hot topics, company reviews, and live interviews with mining professionals and leading figures in the mining industry. Introducing your host, Rob Tyson, founder and director of Mining International. With a career covering nearly two decades, Mining International partners with new and junior miners and larger predominant players in the market. With no further ado, here is your host, Rob Tyson.
Hi, mining community. Hope everyone is well and looking forward to the challenges of the mining industry that lie ahead, with the market seemingly very slow at the moment, but looking to pick itself up from the depths of over the last 4 to 5 years. So another episode and another guest on the Dig Deep, the mining podcast. And today we're speaking to John Scorsese, who some of you might know is the partner and portfolio manager and COO of Corona Associates Capital Management. John began his career on Wall Street and worked for the likes of Morgan Stanley, and has a career expanding 40 years. So has a wealth of knowledge and experience of global markets, especially in the commodities and resources space. But I'll let John explain more about that in detail as we go through this podcast. But I want to welcome John. How are you doing, John?
I am fine. Thank you, Rob. And it's great to be part of your podcast. So yes. Thank you for inviting me.
No worries. And I appreciate you taking the time to do this. Whereabouts are you at the moment?
At the moment, I am in Colorado, mountain state of Colorado.
No worries. And I suppose that's early in the morning here because it's late afternoon here.
Correct. It is little bit past 9 a.m.
Okay. So you've been up for a little while then.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So I just want to obviously start this podcast initially. If you can give the listeners an overview and a background of yourself for people out there that may not know you. So from when you graduated and then obviously working on Wall Street and just briefly going through your career to where you are today. And then I've got a few questions to ask you.
Well, I began my career just after leaving graduate school. I attended the University of Chicago, where I had studied finance and received my MBA from the University of Chicago. Just prior to that, I had been an undergraduate at Yale University, where I got my BA, and I had always been interested in the financial markets, even as a fairly young person, and that really drove my interest in terms of what I had studied in school, and I had a very predetermined path that I wanted to work in the area of financial markets, and so I was fortunate enough to be able to begin my career in 1981 at Morgan Stanley. Yeah. I should like to mention that in that particular year, the price of gold and the price of the Dow Jones Industrial Average was essentially the same number, 850.
Right. Okay.
And I think that was kind of a symbolic period. It was also a period in which interest rates were very near their all-time high. Yeah. And from that point onward, more or less, we saw, you know, the beginning of the era in which we are still in which, you know, rates began a long, protracted, multi-decade decline. And a lot of other things happened, but I think it explains why we are where we are. And I always think of that as the starting point for any examination of the investment landscape.
So you were on Wall Street. How was that?
You know, it was a very interesting time because, you know, it was the onset of an explosion of debt that filled the world. You know, what Wall Street really is a financial product factory. Yep. So as debt expanded, Wall Street expanded. So you needed to create that debt. You needed to trade that debt. You needed to slice it, dice it, package it. and service it. So what followed was an explosion in the financial services industry. I remember starting out at Morgan Stanley, where the newly minted recruits from business school had a cocktail session with the then president of Morgan Stanley, a wonderful man by the name of Richard Fisher.
Yeah.
And he began his chat with us. There were about 20 of us. By saying, you know, you have no idea how lucky you are to be starting when you are. And he went on to use as his point of reference the fact that Morgan Stanley had at that present moment in time $100 million of capital in 1981.
Yeah.
And by comparison, he said, do you understand that just 2 years ago in 1979, our firm capital was $10 million. Now, if you were to look at it today, and I don't know exactly what that number is today, but I would imagine it looks something like a telephone number.
Yeah.
Some enormous number, which was never the way any of these investment banks operated. But of course, once the nature of the industry changed, you needed to have an enormous balance sheet. And that really kind of encapsulates a lot of the characteristics of then and now. And it mirrors the explosion of debt that began, I would say, in 1971,
yeah,
when our money became detached
of the gold standard
from gold, which, yeah, is the entity that gave that money value.
Yep, I understand that. I've been listening to a lot of Robert Kiyosaki. So I've been listening to a lot of him, and obviously he talks a lot about obviously the gold standard and talks a lot about debt. So I understand round about what you're talking about. So when you left Wall Street, how did your career then develop?
Well, I wore various hats while I was at Wall Street. I was an institutional equity salesman at Morgan Stanley. And one of the desks that I started out in was a desk that handled the corporate repurchasing for our investment banking clients. So we had various stock repurchasing programs that we were managing for companies like Eastman Kodak, AT&T, and many others, Eli Lilly, probably a couple of dozen companies. Interestingly, there was something I just read recently regarding stock repurchasing. I had read recently, just in the last week or two, that something like 60 or 70% of all the new capital that has entered the equity markets, specifically the United States, has come from companies repurchasing their stock.
Okay.
Now, What is interesting about that is that when I began doing this in 1981, it had only been 2 years since it was even legal for a company to repurchase its stock. Up until 1979, it was illegal. So for 50 years, and as a result of the stock market crash of 1929, the government authorities had determined that one of the causes of, you know, rampant speculation and so on had been, and abuses of the capital markets had been, companies repurchasing their stock.
Yeah.
So fast forward, today it is a major source of liquidity. But, you know, only a few decades ago, it was illegal to do that. And I would venture to guess that we will see a day again where it is outlawed, because,
yeah,
it is something that can be put to great abuse. And I would venture to say that it already has reached that stage.
Yeah. I want to fast forward to obviously your current situation, and obviously the COO of Corona Associates Capital Management. Can you tell us a little bit about your the company, and what you've done so far, and what you've achieved?
Well, we originally set this up as a effort to capitalize on what we perceived was a misperception in the markets of where we were and where we were headed. And specifically, it had to do with, our view of valuations, our view of the form of money and value that we were using and that we assume every day.
Yeah.
And the role of gold and the role of debt and as it plays out in all these things. And, we believed that we had a very different view and one that was going to be adopted in the future. And maybe that future is upon us now. But that essentially big returns in markets are driven by changes in perception. So we believed that, we had been in a very long and protracted era of financial assets, and that we were about to shift into an era of real assets. And in the process of that transition, it would drive great valuation changes, both in terms of real assets and in terms of the valuations of financial assets, which have become the standard in which wealth is both measured and stored. And we think that is about to change.
Okay. And how's the company grown since you obviously started or formed it?
Well, we've had a very stop and go kind of cycle. And part of it is basically how we've reached out in terms of, trying to find like-minded investors. And then also the turbulence we've had in terms of this transitionary period where you go from things that are in favor to things that are out of favor and you get whipsawed as that occurs. And that pretty much describes a lot about the last recent years of gold. And it also describes a lot of the on and off favor of the gold mining sector and also the general equities environment in terms of running hot and cold. And superimposed on all that is the fact that, we are dealing with markets that are very heavily managed. And by that, I mean, all of the efforts to manage interest rates, that is really a form of intervention. And I would argue that the intervention has been very pervasive in all aspects of the capital markets, and it has been ongoing and unrelenting since 2008, 2009, after the financial crisis first hit. And what I think we are at right now is the end of that period in which you can intervene in that manner. And achieved a desired result from the point of view of the central planners, the central bankers, and so on. But in those latter stages, as we are right now, there are a lot of cross currents before a new kind of trend emerges. And I think we are at that turning point now, and that's what makes what we are seeing in the gold market very interesting, and it has, I think, tremendous implications going forward.
Okay. As a value investor or values investor, how do you evaluate specific opportunities and what financial fundamental metrics do you look for in publicly traded mining or royalty or even exploration companies? In sort of, I suppose, gold or silver?
Well, that's a great question. I think in terms of general equities, it's the standard financial metrics. One looks at the balance sheet, one looks at the cash flow statement, and one looks at the valuation. When it comes to things like gold that people feel is not a asset that can be easily evaluated from a financial perspective, what I like to do is to examine where we are when you look at gold and silver in terms of both market cap and also in terms of where it stands in the pyramid of other wealth assets, which would basically give you an idea whether something is in favor or out of favor. How much of the general investor appetite does it hold? And it gives you an idea of whether, you know, we're at the point of where something is greatly out of favor or something is being adopted, and what kind of valuation changes you would see in that asset if it were to be more a portion of people's portfolio, et cetera. So, you know, those are roughly the general kind of parameters that we would use. And when it comes to a specific company, you know, we look at, you know, mostly the balance sheet and, you know, the cycle of revenues that a company is in. And obviously mining is a little bit different, where you have to evaluate a company's reserves and the wherewithal and ease at which those reserves can be exploited.
Yeah. I mean, how do you see the relationship dynamic between gold and the US dollar playing out sort of moving forward?
Well, I have a slightly different view. Obviously, traditionally, gold and the dollar are inversely related. But I think, you know, we are at a point where that can be a very different dynamic right now. And by that, I mean, we're at a point where we're at the end of a debt cycle. One of the things that I would like to point out is that as we entered this multi-decade cycle where we expanded the debt by, you know, an exponential factor, the one thing that you could say is that our global economy does not expand without the expansion of debt.
Yep.
So we're at this point right now where we have the greatest amount of debt that the world has ever seen. And of course, to service that debt, there's a lot of things that have to happen. One great assist in that is an expanding economy. We don't have that right now. In fact, the great risk and fear is that the global economies are actually on the verge of contracting. My own view is that we have begun to contract. So that becomes a very important headwind. The other thing that is an important factor is the cost of servicing that debt, which, of course, interest rates are the primary driver in that. And that explains why there was such an effort made to lower interest rates and to bring them, you know, at or even below zero. Because even you and I, Rob, we could hold personally an infinite amount of debt if we didn't have a positive interest rate to service that debt.
Yeah, certainly.
The problem becomes, you know, what happens if those interest rates go up? But, you know, while we don't have that as an immediate concern, I believe it's a longer term concern. What we do have is the threat of what happens to that debt if the global economy contracts. And what starts to happen is that debtors are pressured to repay that debt. And because the US dollar is such an important funding currency, and it may be the world's most important funding currency, I've seen different numbers, but I believe there's a consensus around the number that there could be something between 2 and 3 trillion US dollars that have been borrowed by entities, both private and public, outside of the United States.
Okay.
So as those entities feel pressured to repay that money, what they have to do essentially is to go out into the marketplace and purchase dollars, because it's dollars that they need to return to retire that debt. So what's interesting about the gold market right now is that the price of gold measured in dollars has gone up, even though the measure of the value of the dollar in popular dollar indices like the DXY have also gone up. So we're in that period where the dollar and gold have gone up. And I think they've gone up for different reasons. The dollar's going up because there is a constant and growing bid for dollars to repay enormous amounts of debt. Gold is going up, I believe, because of fear. We are in some kind of systemic risk or threat. And that's what makes this period different. And my own view right now is that the dollar and gold can continue to go up, and we could also have the potential for a super spike in the dollar. And it may mean that the rally in gold could be interrupted. It could be subject to a dramatic pullback because there's another thing that, you know, I think is also, you know, very important for investors to consider, which is the so-called market of gold is really comprised of two things. It's physical gold. That's what the mining companies take out of the ground. And that physical gold that is taken out of the ground is added to the inventory of gold that has existed from 5,000 years ago. And it's measured probably somewhere in the area of 180,000 metric tons. All of that gold is owned by someone. All of it is subject for anyone to sell at any point in time. That's what makes gold different from any other thing or commodity. I don't think gold is a commodity. I think it's money. But it doesn't depend on the flow. It's really the stock of gold that matters. And the other aspect is the so-called paper gold, which began sometime in the 1980s, and it was completely a financial instrument. And it has expanded dramatically. So it's a rather vague amount to kind of get a handle on. I have seen numbers that suggest it towers over the amount of physical gold by a factor of 100 to 500 times. But the point of all that is that these two things combined are what satisfies the daily demand for gold as an investment asset. So we have to consider going forward what is going to happen to that paper gold. And I would argue that the paper gold was used by central planners, central bankers, to manage the price of gold. This is something that we've known for several decades. And the way to kind of put a cap on it is to increase the amount of paper gold that is outstanding. And that's been done very carefully, very methodically, using entities like the Bank for International Settlements that have created leases and other devices, guarantees that were backed by central bank gold. But in effect, what they did was they expanded the amount of paper gold to the point of where it is right now. The reason that's important is that this, the integrity of that paper gold has to be maintained, because if it is not, it would undermine the integrity of our entire financial system. So I would take us back to the few words that were uttered by Mario Draghi at the early stages of his tenure at the ECB. And I think they are going to be the words that he will always be remembered by, which is that he was going to do, quote unquote, whatever it takes. And I think it's really the euphemism for what all the central bankers and central planners are going to do. They are going to maintain this system using whatever it takes. And that includes keeping that paper gold alive. So I think right now we're at the end stages of the ability to keep all this together. But they're not going to roll over, voluntarily or easily. So we could expect some kind of, you know, major effort to cap the price of gold, because there's another problem we have now, which is, if you look at the market cap of physical gold, I would say, you know, take 180,000 tons, multiply it by approximately 50 million US dollars in round numbers per metric ton, and you get a number that is somewhere in the vicinity of $10 trillion. That means the market cap of physical gold is multiples of Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, you know, all these so-called popular large cap stocks combined. It is a giant in terms of market cap. What if the paper gold is 100 times that or several hundred times that? What it means is that to move that price of gold for that so-called gold market, it's like strapping a 10-ton boulder to your back and trying to climb some very steep mountain. It is very difficult to do. The amount of money that is required to move the needle is almost breathtaking to think about. So that's what gold has to do to go higher and higher and higher. It's got to move not just the physical, you know, market cap, it's got to move the paper gold market cap. And the risk is that if it were to go too far too fast, which is certainly a possibility, you could have a default in the paper gold market, which we've had near defaults in the past. They have been very carefully papered over, literally. But if you did have a bona fide default of that paper gold, the integrity of it goes away overnight, and it basically undermines the entire financial system. So I don't think that that will be allowed to happen unless things get completely out of control, in which case the financial system is, you know, reset anyway. So so my own view is that while it looks great to see the mining stocks go up, it looks great to see gold go up, I don't believe the period of volatility is over. For people that have been long-term investors in mining stocks, as I have, we have seen some heart-stopping moments where these things, you know, go completely out of favor almost overnight, and the impact in terms of the prices is severe. So I'm not sure that some of the people that are chasing these right now are really up to the volatility that comes along with them. And I question how easily it will be to push that boulder in terms of the gold market further and further uphill, given the kind of flows you would need to do that. So it's a watchword for the wary to be aware of, you know, what could be, you know, extreme volatility ahead.
Yeah. I wonder how you would strategically sort of invest in the precious metal miners now, obviously, given from what you've just said.
You know, I think that, you know, there's a near-term point of view and there's a distant point of view, but I think they're both important to keep in mind. From a distant point of view, if we ever have a reset, which I think at some point is inevitable, because the ability to keep this financial system going, which requires the ability to continue to expand the aggregate amount of debt, I think that is, wishful thinking, because there's a point in which no one can continue to pretend that this debt is even payable.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing that people have to remember is that every single piece of debt that is out there is another person's asset. That's why that debt cannot be allowed to default. If it does, the whole financial system goes down. Yeah. If you remember the Greek crisis that is maybe 8 years old or so, the Greek people and the Greek government actually voted in favor of defaulting. But their debt overlords, the ECB or the, you know, European authorities, would not let them default. And they literally turned around, gave them more money, and then took it back in a symbolic way of saying that, you know, you just paid us back now. Our debt is good. But the Greeks walked away with even more debt. That debt wasn't that large a number in the scheme of things, but it was big enough where it threatened the entire system.
Yeah.
So the point is, debt default is not an option. So that's the problem we have right now. How do you expand it when it's already reached the point where it is more than just problematic? So if you were to replace the system where you go back to, instead of using debt as your standard of value, you use something like gold, which has been the standard that we used for so long, you know, what happens to gold? And I think the answer is that it becomes so highly valued, it becomes the source of global liquidity. And in order to do that, you basically have to reprice gold to a level that makes all these other debts seem small. So you come up with astronomical figures for what the price of gold would be. And of course, if it becomes that valuable, in other words, to cover these debts in a reset, then what happens to the value of that gold in the ground? Is there a real threat that at some point, you know, governments who have gold in the ground basically say, you know, that gold is too valuable and it's a national asset.
Yep.
You know, we're not going to let a mining company claim it. So we'll let the mining companies be paid, maybe well paid, to take it out of the ground. But make no mistake, it belongs to the country. So you could have a situation like that, and where if gold becomes money, you literally will change the arrangement in which companies are not allowed to mine money. So that is a longer term threat. In the near term, I think we're at the stage where people are going to realize that there is some value to owning real assets when money is becoming debased, where money no longer achieves a positive return because interest rates are negative.
Yeah.
Right now, interest rates are negative on approximately $15 trillion worth of national and private debt, which is just breathtaking to think about. So I think we're, you know, now at a place where things are shifting. But again, you're also at a place where the financial system is at risk. So what do the central planners do about that? Do they continue to let gold go up and perhaps, you know, create the threat of a default in the paper gold market? And then what happens to the value of the dollar if there is a panic in terms of, you know, people that want to repay debt and demand dollars and create a dollar shortage, which I believe is happening right now. You can see it in the euro dollar market.
Yeah.
So there are some extremely large dynamics and powerful dynamics in place right now. How they interact with one another is very hard to see at the present time. I think the only thing that you can conclude for certain is that we are likely entering a period of the highest volatility we have ever seen. And it means that we're leaving behind one of the periods of the lowest volatility we've ever seen, particularly for assets like gold, but almost for every other asset as well. So in light of that, I think for mining investors, they have to be aware that there could be some heart-stopping moments where the price of gold, you know, enters some kind of a correction and it gets played out even more severely in the mining stocks. There's all sorts of things, but I think, you know, we're going to see a period of high volatility, and I don't believe this period is going to be like the early part of 2016, where gold and the mining stocks took off and literally didn't stop until some of these mining indices almost doubled or tripled in 6 months. I don't see that happening.
Yeah. I mean, from an investment opportunity point of view, how do you see gold versus silver? Obviously, we've been speaking about money and gold. How about gold and silver?
I believe that although the two are precious metals, there is a difference in the fundamental difference between gold and silver is that gold is the primary monetary metal.
Yeah.
And it is what the central banks own. So that is going to be the instrument that is used by the central banks if they ever have to, you know, press the panic button or the reset button. You know, and it gets back to why is gold used as an asset by central banks? And the, you know, the clear reason is that you use gold because literally central banks, when it really comes down to it, do not trust other central banks.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting concept. In the 90s and in the period of 2000 and so on, those two decades where central banks openly sold gold. Here's an interesting question for your listeners. Why would a central bank that can print money at will, why would they ever sell gold? If they needed the money, they could just print it.
Yeah.
The only reason to sell gold is to manage its price, period.
Got you.
And, you know, you can always print any amount of money that you want to pay whatever amount of bills you want, as long as that money is accepted in the marketplace for goods and services. And that is really what central banks are protecting. They are protecting the value of their paper.
Yeah.
And when things get dicey, that gold sits there as a reserve in the case of an emergency when you cannot trust other people's paper or even your own paper. And that's where we are, you know, threatened right now. We may be very well entering that period, which explains why a lot of other central banks were buying gold so determinedly in the last, you know, decade plus, you know, certainly China, certainly Russia. But now there's a whole list of other central banks, including ones that are part of the Western orbit. And by that, it would include, you know, countries like Poland, for example. Poland in the last 2 years have just entered the gold market where they have never been part of the gold market. Countries are preparing for something. And, you know, that is the important thing to think about. So what they're going to protect is the value of that asset that they hold, you know, for an emergency. They do not hold silver. So, and silver is used in an industrial manner. So, you know, at least 50% or more of the silver that is mined is actually used in industrial applications. If we are going into a global recession, which I believe we've already entered, the demand for all things that are inputs in industrial products will also go down. So that's what makes silver different. I do believe that silver has an interesting story, and I do believe that it is cheap as a metal and as a precious metal, but I do not believe that the story about silver is the same as gold. So I think it has its own story, and I think it's a positive one. But I think in terms of monetary changes, the monetary metal is gold and only gold.
Yeah. Just going on from what you just said, obviously a lot of central banks buying gold. And obviously you mentioned quite a few countries there looking to buy gold. What are your thoughts about countries like the UK that actually sold their gold? And that this was probably, I don't know, 5 years ago, or probably a little bit longer than that, they sold quite a large amount of gold. What hope do they have then? And what's the reason behind them selling gold? And what reserves would they have?
Well, there is actually a very interesting story, Rob, behind the sale of the UK gold. And it covered the period in which Gordon Brown was the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that period or that moment of that gold sale is referred to affectionately as Brown's Bottom. I believe it was somewhere in the mid $200 range, in which I believe it was something like 200 tons of UK gold was from the Bank of England was sold.
Yeah.
But interestingly, in various footnotes that followed that period, where I believe the succeeding chancellor of the Exchequer, whose name now escapes me, but in various interviews and transcripts, he basically said, when he was asked, to comment on the thinking and what was going on at that time to motivate that sale, basically what he said, if I understood it correctly, was that the price of gold began to rise and it threatened, his actual words is that we stared into the abyss. And it was believed that what he was referring to by the abyss was that a very major bullion bank who had entered into a lease agreement with the Bank of England for the bulk of the 200 tons, the price rise of gold was threatening the financial integrity of that bullion bank and its ability to return the gold to the Bank of England. So in effect, as I understand it, the gold was not actually sold by the Bank of England. The lease that was already in effect from prior years was rewritten so that the lease became a sale and they closed their books. That bullion bank, which was believed to be Goldman Sachs. And interestingly, the person running the London office of Goldman Sachs at the time and who was the firm's head gold trader was none other than Robert Rubin, who later became the CEO of Goldman Sachs and then later became the U.S. Treasury Secretary. Anyway, it was believed that that sale was a retroactive rewriting of the lease agreement with Goldman Sachs, where Goldman was no longer in the position of being able to return the gold, that they were in a position of defaulting, and that the financial consequences of a default from Goldman Sachs was enough to unearth the entire, financial system. So they basically closed out the lease as a sale.
Okay,
and then gold went up many, many fold from there.
So does the presence of Bitcoin, so we're talking something a little bit different here, sort of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies change the dynamics of precious metals invested?
I think that the world is starved for alternative forms of money and assets, wealth assets, and means to store wealth. My own personal view is that Bitcoin is not an effective store of wealth. For one thing, it is simply too volatile. For another thing, to keep the crypto, universe of cryptocurrencies ongoing and alive, I have read that it actually uses the amount of electricity that is required, or I should say would be annually consumed by a country the size of Ireland, for example. That seems to me like a rather extraordinarily inefficient type of asset, let alone considering that it only works if the internet and the networks are available and that sort of thing. I'm very skeptical about its longevity. I can understand how something new can acquire people's attention and all of a sudden it becomes the talk of the town, so to speak. But then you also have to look at it in terms of its overall market cap. And I'm not exactly current on what it may be right now, but I think all of the cryptocurrencies are something below combined, are something below $500 billion. I think it's probably closer to $400 billion US dollars in market cap. Well, I don't consider that something that really matters. It's not big enough to really matter. What flows of capital are required to move an asset that size, to move the needle, are not very great in terms of overall volume. And I believe that it's also something that is controlled by a few large entities that were the ones that were in there from the very beginning when this thing was created literally out of an algorithm. And so, you know, it's easy to control the price of these things. It's easy to manipulate these things. They don't even have exchanges that I believe have very much oversight or any kind of regulation. So I think you're basically, if you choose to invest in these things, you're choosing to be part of the Wild West, and it is a highly speculative market. And I think the other thing that has assisted this is that there have been some big changes going on around the world. Right now, for example, imagine if you were a Chinese investor or Chinese citizen, and you were worried about, because your currency is going down and it may be devalued even more, you want to get money out of the country. Or you're someone in Iran or someone in any of these places. This could be a means for you to basically get capital out of a country in which there are substantial capital controls. You're not considering it a real wealth asset by buying it. You're considering it a way that you can get your wealth out temporarily through the medium of a cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
And maybe even care if by the time you get that money out and you get yourself out of that country, its value has gone up or down by 10%. But a long-term wealth asset is not one that has the kind of volatility that these cryptos have, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And they're too small to really matter in the global scheme of things. If I'm right about the gold market in terms of how to size the market cap, there isn't a single other wealth asset that is even in the league of gold.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's ever going to change. And if anything, it's going to get bigger. One of the interesting studies that I had seen where someone had looked at gold as a wealth asset going back hundreds of years, there was never a single point in time prior to the last 100 years, there was never a single year in which gold as a wealth asset, as the percentage of wealth that was carried in gold, was ever below 25% or ever above 40%. If you look at it now, Rob, it's something below a half of 1%.
Okay, yeah.
And that's because of where we are in the era of, you know, the era of debt and the era of financial assets on steroids. And that's the part that's going to change, because without being able to expand debt, that era ends.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that right now, in my opinion.
And where do you see ourselves in the mining market? Whereabouts are we in the cycle within the sort of mining industry, and with, I suppose, across the range of commodities?
You know, we have seen, you know, about a decade ago, there was a popular school of thought that was referred to as peak oil, where we had entered the side of the bell curve where the world was going to produce fewer and fewer barrels of oil each year, and that would have an important consequence on, you know, global economic health and growth going forward. I think there's actually more than anecdotal evidence that we may have entered the period of peak gold, and maybe we've already, you know, seen that happen. We've seen that happen in South Africa. We are seeing it happen in China. You know, China was the world's largest gold miner. And interestingly, you know, when the Chinese take gold out of the ground, every gram of gold that is taken out of the ground in the country of China belongs to the government.
Okay.
And they even use the Chinese military to take that gold out of the ground. It is considered a national priority. And that gold never leaves the hands of the government. It never gets sold. So whatever that production is, and it's been running around 400 tons per annum, I believe, something around that number. it has been in decline, and it's because the yield of gold that they're taking out of the ground is steadily declining. And that's pretty much the story around the world. You know, we have found the elephant deposits. We haven't had any recent discoveries of some new elephant deposit, and we're, you know, moving down. And in fact, we exploited in, you know, since the 1980s, we exploited new techniques like, you know, the heap leaching methods, to basically draw out more gold from a dwindling supply that's in the ground. It's almost the equivalent, Rob, of what we are doing or have been doing right now with respect to oil fracking.
Yeah.
You know, I think of it as what happens when you put a straw in the glass of Coke that has a bunch of ice cubes in. When you get to the bottom, there's still something there that you can suck out of the straw.
Yeah.
But it's quite the same drink that you get, you know, when the glass is full. But, you know, when you're doing that, you're at the end of something. You're not at the beginning of something. And, you know, I think it's going to become more and more problematic to take ever greater amounts of gold out of the ground. And even if the price goes up, you come up to the limits of, you know, how much does it take to extract gold from these marginal areas, which is similar to the dilemma of how much does it take in both energy and monetary resources to take oil out of the ground, where that oil, you know, is very marginal. And literally you come up against the laws of physics. If it takes more energy to draw out a given amount of oil than that oil that you take out represents in the form of energy, it's not going to be touched.
Yeah.
And gold, similar thing. If it takes more money to take that gold out of the ground than that gold is worth, it's not going to be touched.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. I'm going to slowly wrap this up now. I just want to move off gold for the moment. What opportunities do you sort of currently see in the uranium sector for someone's investment portfolio? I've been, and just more recently, I have been speaking to a few people on the more recent podcasts around uranium. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
You know, I think that uranium is going to be a very important source and reliance on of our energy needs going forward. It is, you know, it has its own environmental risks, and obviously they are very serious. I mean, Japan is probably going to be dealing with their environmental disaster for a very long time. And so that environmental risk is certainly one to be, you know, treated realistically, and also one that needs to be factored into the cost of exploiting uranium as an energy source. And I think previously when people said, well, this is how much it costs to produce a megawatt of energy using uranium, they never adequately addressed the cost of storing those waste byproducts.
Okay, yeah.
So at some point, you know, we'll do an honest assessment of what the true cost is to the world of using uranium. But I think that, you know, from an environmental point of view, setting aside the risks of waste materials that come out of the process, setting aside the risk of, you know, a plant disaster like Chernobyl or something, which are real risks. But I would be of the camp that suggests there is a way to mitigate those risks in a manner that is safe to the world. But that there is a cost to that. I think that if you can put your arms around those issues, the safety issues and the environmental issues, that uranium has a very bright future because you know, it is clean from an emissions or a carbon point of view, and it is relatively plentiful. There is a lot of that uranium that can be exploited. And if you were to bridge, let's say, the next 100 years using that as an important source of your energy needs, I'm quite convinced that the nuclear industry can evolve into using other materials and safer techniques where, the whole idea of nuclear energy is one that is improved upon dramatically as time goes on to make it safer and more efficient and a more reliable energy source and a clean energy source. So I think it has been, depressed in price. I forget now where the recent price of that yellow cake has been trading. I think it's somewhere in the high 20s.
Yeah, it's pretty low.
That represents a very low level, and it represents, part of the ongoing fallout from having taken so many of the Japanese plants out of operation. Same with the German plants. And but I think you're beginning to see both in Japan and other countries, now that the hysteria of that fear has subsided, you're starting to see from a political point of view the move to bring a lot of these plants back online. And the Chinese are moving forward with a very ambitious project to scale up their uranium, or I should say their nuclear energy industry. And so I think it faces a very robust demand curve going forward. And of course, it is a real asset that is in the ground. So I think it's an important asset that the world needs. And, we're going to exploit it. And I think the demand is looking very favorable for it.
Yeah.
Forward.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your time, John, for doing this podcast. I've certainly learned a lot from hearing from you. If our audience wants to contact you, how can they go about doing that?
They can find probably the best way is to go to our website, which is coronacap.com. And anyone can feel free to reach out and, query us in terms of email link that you would find there.
Yeah.
And we would be glad to entertain anyone's questions or comments. And, we think the investment process is one of, constantly learning new things. And one of the great resources is learning from other people. And that's why I've always enjoyed this podcast format and all the people that it can reach and the points of view it can reach. And we can all learn from those things and from one another. And that's the basis of making good decisions. The knowledge and the inputs that you get from the whole gamut of information sources.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I've certainly learned a lot, and this is probably one of the main reasons why I actually started the podcast. So it's sharing information around the mining industry, but looking and speaking to different parts of the mining industry. So it's not just mining people, it's people that are providing services and associated services to the industry. So I've certainly learned a lot from this particular episode. Are you on any social media platforms?
I am not actually. I'm not on Facebook or anything like that. So probably the best way of staying in touch is through our website.
Yep.
So okay. coronacap.com.
Yep. Alternatively, you can contact myself via email, and I can pass the message or questions on to John. My email address is rob@mining-international.org. As always, thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. I certainly did. And until next time, happy mining.
Thanks for listening to Dig Deep, the mining podcast. If there are any topics you want discussed or questions you want to ask any guests, then you can email us at rob@mining-international.org. Or you can follow Rob and Mining International on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube for more content and to have your questions answered. Until next time, Happy mining.